Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Financial markets are absorbing the news today that the U.S. Treasury is considering plans to take ownership stake in troubled U.S. banks. The move is part of the $700 billion bailout plan, and it's intended to help credit markets start lending again. And this is on top of the Federal Reserve Bank's decision to drop its benchmark lending rate. And as officials work to try to keep Wall Street afloat, the presidential campaigns have been focusing on how to help middle-class Americans. Here is Barack Obama speaking at the Indiana State Fair yesterday.
We need a plan that will provide every family immediate relief to cope with rising food and gas prices, save 1 million jobs by rebuilding our schools and our roads, help states and cities avoid budget cuts and tax increases.
And John McCain says he's focusing on helping homeowners in trouble. And that's something he spoke about during this week's debate.
We all know, my friends, until we stabilize home values in America, we're never going to start turning around and creating jobs and fixing our economy.
But the question is, what kind of help do middle-class Americans really need? Well, our guest, Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren, has been studying working and middle-class America for years now. She's authored several books, including The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. And her latest, co-authored with her daughter, is All You're Worth, The Ultimate Lifetime Money Plan. Elizabeth, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
What do you think this bailout plan would do for middle-class Americans?
Well, the first thing, of course, is it would help everybody if we thought it was going to fix the problems out there, and that would ultimately help middle-class families. The problem is, of course, that what Secretary Paulson's trying to do is prop up a market that's sinking, the asset securitization, these fancy instruments that are based on the fact that homeowners should keep paying their mortgages over time, and they've projected that they will. It keeps sinking because the underlying families can't actually make these payments. And when you try to prop up a market at the back end, that is with the securitization, it's not likely to work. And so right now what's happening is stock markets around the world are dropping because the main thing that comes out of the $700 billion bailout is that there's not really a coherent plan here to fix anything, to fix the underlying problems. Let's remember, the underlying problems are middle-class families who can't make these payments.
Hmm. Yeah, well, during the debate this week, the presidential candidates debate, we heard John McCain say that he would like to help homeowners by having the government buy back some of these bad mortgages and at least figure out what home values might be now and how these mortgages compare. Now, I understand the plan's a little vague and there is a provision in the bailout that might do something similar, but what do you think of that whole idea?
Well, it's like everything. The devil's always in the details, right? Ultimately, we have to find a way to keep a lot of families in their homes with mortgages that they can pay for. And we need to do that in part for the individual families, but we also need to do it because that's what's going to stabilize the economy. The enormous uncertainty over how many people are going to walk away from their homes, how far the values are going to fall, is creating chaos and, frankly, loss for all of us. But when I say the devil's in the details, what it really comes down to is how are you going to get mortgage lenders, investors, that's what they are, to take their losses and write down the value on these homes to something that's realistic in today's marketplace. And here's where the problem arises. There's something in the bailout that says, in effect, it's just very open-ended language, that there's authorization to go out and buy some mortgages. But in the bailout package, it says, in effect, and the investors have to take some of the loss here. They're the ones who wrote these mortgages for $200,000 and the property is only worth, let's say, $125,000. And they've got to take some or all of that $75,000 loss. John McCain, initially, I assumed that's what he was talking about, the same thing that's in the bill. But evidently, according to his website, he's talking about paying the full face value, the full $200,000 to the investors. Now, the good news is for the family, okay, you get put into a $125,000 mortgage. But the very bad news for the taxpayer is the taxpayer is picking up, in my example, a $75,000 bill and just keep multiplying that out times millions of families in order to pay off a lot of investors who made a lot of bad loans. And that's bad for two reasons. Obviously, the big reason it's bad is in the long term, you're rewarding really bad behavior, and that means you're going to get a lot of it and it's going to continue. But in the short term, so long as the people who are holding this bad mortgage paper believe that John McCain or anybody else is going to come along and say, pay the face value of that paper, even though everyone in the market understands that it's worth 30% less, 40% less, 50% less, there's somebody out there who may put government dollars to give you 100 cents on the dollar, then what happens is no investor has an incentive to work with the homeowner right now to try to work out a plan privately. In other words, they all move to the sidelines and say, I'm waiting for a government handout here.
So who are some of these people who are having mortgage trouble, would you say, right now? The people facing foreclosure, who's the majority?
Well, the majority are just ordinary middle-class families who bought homes during the housing boom or who refinanced homes during the housing boom. There are some speculators in there, although, to tell you the truth, the speculators are the ones who get dumped the fastest because they can't make their payments. They're trying to make payments on multiple places. You know, they were counting on flipping and refinancing to keep going. They fall out the fastest, and many of them have already fallen out. So what we're really looking at here is this enormous pool of American homeowners, you know, you, me, our neighbors, people, and this is what's ironic. In many cases, people who thought, dang, this looks like a terrible, you know, payment for me to take on. Wow, paying $400,000 for, you know, two bedrooms and one and a half baths. Who can do that? But many times we're stampeded by this rising market and very much the feeling that if I don't buy right now, I'm never going to be able to buy. I'll be closed out of this market forever and ever and ever. So it's a lot of normal, ordinary folks, you know, not people who were trying to do anything fancy, but just people who were trying to get by.
But there has been an argument that, you know, a lot of these mortgages were adults. They entered into financial agreements, complicated though they might be. They need to make the payments and live up to the deals that they made.
Well, the problem is you really have to stop and ask. So exactly what do you think the deal is that they made? The way many of these mortgages were designed is teaser rates, 2/28. And so people were given a low, low price of, you know, a monthly payment of $600 a month. And that was the number shoved in front of them. And, yeah, the mortgage papers were an additional 330 pages longer. And, you know, there were 147 different places where you signed them. Nobody can read and understand those details. I teach contract law at Harvard Law School, and I can't read and understand all those documents. And when they reset in the 25th month, the number of people who were stunned to discover that, in fact, they had signed contracts for exploding mortgages is staggering. So I think what we have to do here is we have to remember this was not exactly a level playing field where people walked onto this mortgage market and said, hey, I'm looking for a 2/28 with a reverse double flip and a prepayment penalty that'll go over 5 and cost me an additional $80,000. Let's keep in mind the mortgage brokers, for example, literally when they sold people, when they talked to people over the phone or you went into their offices, they pulled out rate sheets that literally said, if you sell these people, in effect, a clean mortgage, you'll get a little tiny percentage. But if you sell them a mortgage that's kind of dirty, that is, has a bunch of tricks in it, and has this prepayment penalty, and has this big jump up later on, we'll pay you a little more. And if you sell them one that's really dirty, we'll pay you a whole lot more. And that's the environment in which many of these mortgages were taken out.
Well, there are, you know, subprime mortgages, obviously, and all kinds of home equity loans that were given out as well, using these ballooning values in homes for people to basically use their homes as ATM cards, which we've read quite a bit about. But also, the decrease now in value has had this sort of trickle-down effect for a lot of people. And, Elizabeth, I'd like to play you a piece of tape. Recently, my colleague, Bob Oakes, spoke with several people, a very diverse group of people, about the economy and the uncertainty that is out there because of what's happening in this financial crisis. And he spoke with Helen Ramirez. She's an office manager for a police department in Massachusetts, and she's also a part-time real estate agent. She just went through a divorce, and she can't sell her house. She said it's been on the market for 200 days. Here's how she described her situation.
I took all the right steps, went and got my license for a real estate agent. Figured it would be something good part-time. Had a cushion that I could depend on while I sold my house. But unfortunately, that cushion's gone, and I'm still in the house. I really don't see any relief for me tomorrow or next month. So I am scrambling. I am struggling.
Are you worried you're going to lose your house?
It's getting to that point. I've been there 20 years. I've never been late on my mortgage. And I've called the mortgage company, tried to have them work with me. But because I have good credit, because I have a good credit rate, they told me to have a relative move in.
That's Helen Ramirez, an office manager for a police department in Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren, have a relative move in? I know that may not seem like certainly any kind of serious negotiating on the mortgage company's part, but are you hearing stories like Helen's where she has lost her cushion? She has the credit to be able to do this, but she's very anxious about what's going on.
You know, this is the story I'm hearing all the time. It's people, these are not people who want to walk away from their obligations. These are not people who said, gee, let me go out and let me gamble with the place I've lived in for 20 years and see if I can make an extra 10%. These are people who thought they were following the rules. Let's keep in mind that the people who are in trouble on mortgages right now are the people who listened to Alan Greenspan for 10 years, as he kept saying, oh, get into adjustable rate mortgages, refinance your home, use home equity lines of credit in order to tap your equity. Borrow, 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 said the man who was supposed to be the smartest economist in America. And now we've got people who desperately want to meet their obligations. They're trying to meet their obligations. They are moving in family members. They're handing over the keys and moving out because they can't figure out what else to do. They are caught in a market that is much bigger than they are. These are small boats in a very stormy sea.
Which brings us to credit overall and credit cards that we will touch upon after a break, but we do have to take a break. We will return and bring up the whole issue of credit and our lending system and how that figures into all of this. So stay with us, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Warren is a Harvard law professor. She's the author of several books, including The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. We'll have more from her after a break. Also, the fallout from Wall Street washes up on the shores of Iceland. It's Here and Now. We're back with Elizabeth Warren. She's Harvard University law professor. We're talking about the economy and the middle class. And Professor Warren, before the break, you mentioned the policies of former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan and the use of credit and home values to finance things for consumers. I'm wondering, can you just give us a brief snapshot of what has happened in terms of credit for the middle class?
Well, the very short version here is that the middle class has suffered from flat or declining incomes just across the board when adjusted for inflation and rising core expenses, not just housing, but also health insurance, child care, transportation, big expenses you can't get around. And so what families have done is they have turned to credit. They carry much more mortgage debt than they used to in the past, and they carry much more credit card debt than they used to in the past. Today, there are 50 million American families who cannot pay off their credit card bills. That is, they roll them from month to month to month, paying interest and fees because they just don't have enough money. They're in my view, already in the red flashing light zone. That is in financial risk because they're going to hit this bad economy already owing a lot of high interest debt.
And you have a proposal for regulation of credit in general. Is that right?
That's right. Part of what troubles me about all of this that we talk about here is that we have much more regulation for all physical products. You can't go buy a toaster that has a 1 in 12 chance of exploding, but you can certainly buy a mortgage that has a 1 in 12. In fact, you can buy a mortgage that has a 1 in 5 chance of going into collapse, and the lender can know it at the time they lend it to you, at the time they make the loan. They can see the projection, see that you can't meet the income in 25 months, and know that you're going to lose your house over this. And yet, under today's laws, they don't have to tell you. We live in a world in which the most important financial decisions in your life are largely unregulated. And to the extent there's any regulation, it's diffuse, it's fractured, and it's mostly controlled by people in Washington, like the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency or the Federal Reserve, whose principal responsibility is the profitability of the banks and other financial institutions, not the safety of the family.
Well, Elizabeth Warren, I'm sure we will continue to check in with you as we get more details about regulation and what it might look like and how this all might play out. But thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren is author most recently of a book with her daughter. It's titled All You're Worth, The Ultimate Lifetime Money Plan. The worldwide financial crisis is threatening to bankrupt the island nation of Iceland. The country of 300,000 people suspended trading on its stock exchange today, and it's taken over the nation's three largest banks. Iceland's currency, the krona, lost half its value against the euro this year, and politicians are calling for the head of the central bank there to step down. Joining us on the line from Iceland is Ólafur Ifliðason. He's an assistant professor at Reykjavik University School of Business. Hello, professor.
Good afternoon.
Before we talk about how this crisis got started, how are people in Iceland reacting to what's been happening there in terms of your country's financial meltdown?
Well, obviously, the people are very worried about the situation and the endless row of rather bad news, but they seem, however, to be reacting calmly, and there is also the sense of increased solidarity sort of between people, and so there are also certain, positive effects showing up in all of this.
Your prime minister has said that the country could be on the verge of national bankruptcy, and he also said that he hopes the lesson learned here is one that a small country maybe shouldn't become such a large player in the international banking world. Can you explain the role of international banking in Iceland and briefly what's happened over the past couple of years?
Well, basically what has happened is that we up here, like most other countries, are suffering greatly from this international financial crisis that is now sort of storming the world. I think it is safe to say that we are a little bit more hard hit, at least than some others, because of the fact that we have a banking sector with assets and liabilities much larger than the national economy, like 8 or 10 times larger. So this has made the banking sector very vulnerable here. Also, as you mentioned in your introduction, the independent currency, our krona, has fallen and lost half of its value. And so these sort of two additional problems are making the problems here a little bit sort of tougher to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And of course, these issues are reverberating across Europe. Really, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown threatened to sue Iceland to try to recover deposits of about 300,000 Britons who have accounts in Icelandic banks. We understand that the British government used an anti-terrorism law to freeze some assets. And a reporter actually asked Iceland's prime minister about that in a press conference today. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Would you say that this crisis has now evolved into a crisis between Britain and Iceland? I mean,
I thought so for a few minutes this morning. I thought so for a few minutes this morning when I realized that we are being that a terrorist law was being applied against us. Not many governments have had taken that very kindly, and I told the chancellor that we were not pleased with that.
That's Iceland's prime minister talking about the financial crisis there. Professor, I'm wondering, what does that do you think, to relations between the two countries? And we have a very limited amount of time.
What do you think about throwing petrol at a burning house?
Oh, so it's bad. It's very bad. Can people get, do they have access to their money?
Yeah, I believe they have. The prime minister has stated repeatedly that bank deposits are secure.
Okay, thanks very much for being with us, Professor. Olaf Ilifson is an assistant professor at Reykjavik University's School of Business. More than 3,000 people have been killed across Mexico this year as the government fights increasingly savage battles against drug cartels. At the same time, there's a power struggle among the cartels that appears to be centered just over the California border in Tijuana. A recent story in the Los Angeles Times starts out this way, quote, "The birthplace of one of Mexico's most infamous drug cartels looks more and more like its graveyard. Gunmen and associates of the Arellano Felix cartel, rulers of the city's criminal underworld for two decades, are being massacred by the score." The writer is Richard Morosi of the LA Times, and he joins us from San Diego. And Richard, for those who haven't been following this, paint a picture of what's going on in Tijuana. 400 people killed there this year? It sounds like something out of a gangster movie.
Yeah, it's actually gotten a lot worse than the regular gangster movies. There are some pretty cruel twists to what's going on here in Tijuana recently. The killings have accelerated in the past 2-3 weeks or so as a full-out gang war appears to have hit the city. Hmm. Of course, the city for years has been controlled by the Arellano Felix cartel. They were the model for the drug cartel family in the 2001 film Traffic. But in recent years, they've been having trouble keeping it together, and right now it looks like they're under full assault by other cartels and also from within.
You wrote that 57 suspected drug gang members have been killed in the last week alone, and some of them dumped near an elementary school in Tijuana. And sometimes there are these messages being left behind. Can you describe a little bit about the scene there and who these people are, at least who you think they are right now?
By the way, the death toll is up to near 70 in the past week. There were 4 more bodies found this morning. And often what the killers do is they'll leave behind messages. They're called narco messages, taunting the existing head of the Arellano Felix cartel, a man whose nickname is the Engineer. So they threaten more killings, and then, you know, a couple days later, there'll be more killings, and there'll be another narco message, and the narco messages appeared yesterday again. So the head of the Arellano Felix cartel right now appears to be under siege, so everybody's bracing for the worst over here.
Why now? What is it about this particular time that you're seeing this level of violence?
At this point, all of the drug cartels are under pressure, mainly because of the Mexican government's offensive against them, causing a lot of feuding and wars in different cities to keep the trafficking corridors open. And if the Mexican government disrupts these, they look for other places. And Tijuana right now is vulnerable. The Arellano Felix cartel has been weak for many, many years. So it looks like someone's trying to take these corridors from them.
How lucrative are these corridors?
We're talking billions of dollars. They'll generally try and focus on taking trafficking corridors near major ports of entry. That's why they fight in San Diego. That's why they fight across from San Diego, across from El Paso, and across from Laredo, Texas. These are big areas where lots of trucks and commercial traffic crosses. So it's easy for the cartels to get their drugs through in these areas. there's huge, huge money at stake in all of this.
Hmm. And, of course, you mentioned the backdrop being the crackdown by Mexico's President Calderon to crack down on these cartels. He started that, what, about 2 years ago. And since then, there have been tens of thousands of soldiers deployed, thousands of police officers, and it's getting worse.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. The Mexican government spins it, you know, it's got to get worse before it gets better. If you don't pressure on these cartels, it'll be business as usual, and they'll be moving tons and tons of drugs into the U.S., and they'll be getting richer and more powerful by the day. So in Tijuana, they even see this as a positive sign, some of these politicians, because they're saying, look, they're killing each other off, and they're doing it because we put too much pressure on these people, and they can't move their drugs through. They're normal trafficking channels.
I also read, Richard, that the Interior Secretary said that the drug gangs appear to have infiltrated police.
That's how the games play. They've always infiltrated the police. The Tijuana Police Department has been said for many years is just an arm of the Arellano Felix cartel. So you're never going to eliminate that kind of corruption. There's just too much money in it. You can only try your best to minimize it. The average Tijuana police officer makes $1,300 a month. They're the highest paid police force in Mexico. But still, the Arellano Felix cartel spreads the money around. If they don't take the money, they're threatened with death. So it's either in Mexico, they call it plata o plomo, take my silver or take my lead. So cops are presented with a very difficult choice. And if they do cooperate, if they are clean cops, they're often killed.
Are people afraid in Tijuana?
Tijuana, you know, is a tough city. There's a lot of crime there. This has been probably their worst crime rate. A lot of people are varying their routines, but mostly life goes on. It's a big city. It's nearly 2 million people. Most of these people who have been killed you know, quietly, you know, in the dead of night. They weren't done in public displays of, you know, public shootouts. So for the most part, the city has been spared of dangerous situations or risky situations. And but they're still certainly nervous and bracing for the worst because there have been vicious shootouts in Tijuana in the past.
Is tourism affected?
Oh, tourism was wiped out. I go down there pretty regularly. The famous Avenida Revolucion, they used to boast it's the most visited city in the world. But, you know, right now, on an average day, just a handful of tourists. People, they read the headlines. Even though tourists are not targeted, have largely been unaffected, people read the headlines and they're not willing to risk it. So it's a pretty sad scene down in downtown Tijuana. More than half of the businesses have closed, and the other ones are just hanging on. So it's definitely really hurt the tourism industry in Baja California.
You mentioned the movie Traffic, which brought up the issue of demand for drugs. Is there any movement toward trying to do something about demand from the U.S., which is what the biggest cocaine consumer in the world, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the Mexican government often complains about that the U.S. doesn't do enough to reduce demand. That would go a long way to putting the hurt on these drug cartels. But, you know, not much has been done. I mean, a lot of people propose expanded treatment, legalizing marijuana, but you know what? There's a lot of different things on people's mind these days. Many more issues perceived as being more serious than the drug issue these days, certainly. So it's kind of like the forgotten war, the forgotten issue. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, we talked about this a lot, you know, the cocaine explosion. But now it's kind of forgotten. It's kind of hidden and people don't talk about it as much. So I don't see in the near term any programs or any movement to curtail demand in this country. And also what's helping the drug cartels in Mexico is that Europe has turned into a very big market for cocaine with the rise of the euro and the increasing wealth of European societies. Much of their product goes to Europe these days, and Mexican authorities, when they do seize drugs or money from these cartels, they'll find lots of euro-denominated bills. So that appears to be an expanding market for them as well.
Richard, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay.
Richard Morosi is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. For more on the Mexican drug wars, go to our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, linguist Steven Pinker is our guest. He's been listening closely to the language of the presidential campaign. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. do you know how much your coworkers earn? Or would you like to know, even if that meant going public with your salary? Well, some economic researchers say most of us believe that we are underpaid, and many of us think our colleagues are making more money than they actually are. They say this creates resentment and tension in the workplace, so they also say one solution is salary transparency, posting salaries online, or at least sharing the information within the company. Tracy Fenton is CEO of World Blue, a company that promotes democratic workplaces, and she told us about one company that's already opening up its books on salary information.
Whole Foods, which is a Fortune 500 company, they have salary transparency, and what they do in all of their stores is in the back room, there is a book, a salary book, that lists every person's name of the 35,000-plus employees that work at Whole Foods, every person's name and the amount of money that they make each year.
You know, having a list like that or a book that lists everyone's salary, I think it could sound like a good idea, but obviously there are a lot of things that go along with salary, things that you might not be able to quantify necessarily. Maybe somebody is taking a lower salary for reduced hours. Maybe somebody brings some intangible things to a job and so they're paid more. There are all those kinds of things that a list doesn't really explain. Can't having a list like that actually cause more problems?
Well, what it does is it causes a dialogue to happen. And so when you have something like salary transparency, what that does is it opens up the space to say, okay, how much are people worth? What are they bringing? What's the value they're bringing to the organization? How should that be compensated? How should that be done fairly? You know, unhealthy conversations around salary are happening already, so why not find a way to make them healthier conversations?
Why do you think they're unhealthy already? Why are salaries so taboo?
Well, you know, I think that's something that has been a part of our culture for a long time, and I think it is because we attach worth with what we're paid, and it can be a very sensitive issue, and people never think they're paid what they're worth, usually. Lower-level workers usually think that managers are paid actually more than they are. So this crazy gap and discrepancy that's happening that we really need to have a conversation about.
Couldn't it also have the effect of allowing people or other companies to poach workers and say, hey, we can get a manager from company X for this much less than we're paying someone because we know what they're getting paid over here?
Well, you know, that is a possibility. But I think, too, the larger issue is pay, what motivates people. And what the Gallup organization has shown time and time again is that pay is not the top one, two, or even, I think, third thing on the list. You know, people more and more, particularly Gen X and Gen Y, want to do work that has meaning. They want to work for visionary companies. And so pay is just one part of the whole package of working at a company.
I read a recent Harvard Business Review article that said, you know, there are pitfalls to both, obviously, of publishing everyone's salary and of not, but maybe a middle ground in having ranges published. So at least people would know where they fall within the range and what the potential for their position might be.
Yeah, Deb, I think that can be a great idea, is to do something like ranges. The broader issue, though, is not to just suddenly say, okay, we're going to have salary transparency here at the company. It is really understanding a strategy of moving away from the command and control hierarchical secret society way of running a company into a more open, collaborative, and democratic workplace.
I'm assuming everybody at World Blue knows what everyone else is paid.
Yeah, we do practice open book management, and we are open with salaries as well.
So what's your salary?
Well, we've decided to keep, since we are a private company, we keep that within the company. But maybe ask me a little bit later, maybe I'll tell you.
A little bit later?
Yeah, we decided we would keep that private, but everyone within the organization does know what everyone else makes. And we found that really contributes to creating a healthy workplace where people feel that they're treated fairly and with dignity and respect.
So there's still a little taboo there then, Tracy.
Yeah, maybe so, but I look forward to the day I can let people know what I make.
All right, well, Tracy, thanks very much for being with us.
All right, great to be on the show. Thanks, Deb.
Tracy Fenton is CEO of World Blue, a company that encourages salary transparency, at least within companies. And if you're wondering what some workers might be worth, there might be a way to find out. A website called Glassdoor.com allows employees to list their salaries online, anonymously, of course. When we come back, an Axis of Evil cookbook. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. George Bush's famous axis of evil included Iraq, North Korea, and Iran. But author Chris Fair has added several other countries to that list. As a Washington-based analyst, Fair's expertise is in South Asia. She worked for a variety of think tanks and traveled to all sorts of exotic places to gather material about a country's political situation or its military growth. And while visiting these places, of course, she had to eat. Somehow, Chris Fair managed to put the politics and the food into a book. It's called Cuisines of the Axis of Evil and Other Irritating States, A Dinner Party Approach to International Relations. And Chris, explain the overview of this book.
You know, the origins of it are actually deeply personal for me. Apart from sitting in a diner when the Axis of Evil speech was delivered and the obviousness of, boy, that'd be a great cookbook, shortly thereafter, my brothers were actually called up to Iraq. In the course of that year, I really relied upon my traditional way of handling stress, which is cooking. So in the course of that year, I began throwing dinner parties. They kind of morphed into the Axis of Evil dinner parties. And at some point, I just decided, you know, let's just do a cookbook. Thus, the cookbook was born.
So what do you think a nation's cuisine says about its politics?
You know, when you're hanging out in some of these countries, the politics of food production, who grows it, who makes the food, who gets to eat the leftovers, who gets to eat with whom, is almost inescapable. I remember when I was doing my field work in India and in Pakistan, women are out there, they're doing all of the cultivation in the fields. The husbands are hanging out on their chai pie, drinking their water pipe, while the women are breaking their backs. And of course, when it comes to mealtime production, when they're not out in the fields, the rest of their time is spent in the kitchen. And at the end of the meal, what they get to eat are actually the leftovers of what the menfolk didn't want to eat. And of course, in some places, they can't even eat together. So as a consequence of my research, I really became attuned to what food means. In some countries in the book, I think it's interesting what countries foist up as their national culinary symbols. The most obvious one is Israel, when it purports that falafel is its national cuisine. And, you know, falafel is a quintessentially Arab dish. So I sort of draw the parallel that appropriating falafel is kind of creating culinary facts on the ground in the same way that appropriation of the settlements are. So in many countries, what they eat is really a symbol of national identity, and they promote that explicitly.
So basically, food and politics then go together.
I think they inherently do.
And you cite a bunch of examples of how you think that happens. North Korea, for example.
Well, North Korea is an interesting one because what's most evident about North Korea is that the vast majority of that country's inhabitants are starving. During periods of famine, they literally went into the park to forage for bark. So while the vast majority of the population is starving, you have Kim Jong-ilin, as I call him in the book, who is an absolute gastronomical gourmand. He has chefs coming in from Italy teaching his minions how to make precise pizzas where they're actually calculating and cataloging the pieces of salami on each pizza and the precise distance between them. He's had a couple of chefs escape and do sort of cook and tells. And one of my favorites is his personal sushi chef, who at last absconded. He was actually being hunted down to be killed by the North Korean regime. He wrote a book in Japanese. Unfortunately, it hasn't been fully translated into English, but he does recount some of the culinary escapades of Kim Jong-ilin. One of the things I remember most from that cook and tell memoir was that he insisted, of course, upon the finest fish, and he would send this sushi chef to the finest of Japanese markets. He'd come back with this, you know, lavish catch of fish, and he would request that the sushi chef actually cut the fish with its gills intact such that when Kim Jong-il was eating the fish, it was technically still alive.
You know, you also pointed out about the role that colonization plays.
Oh, yes.
In cuisine, which was really interesting, about how what you say, the only decent food in the UK is from South Asia.
Absolutely. Edible archipelagos of curry shacks. And it's true of all of these countries that have a colonial history. When you're in France, the sort of fast, cheap ethnic food, of course, comes from North Africa. They love their tagines in France. When you're in the Netherlands, it's food from Indonesia. And when you're in Japan, of course, it's going to be Korean food. And here, although we don't have an explicitly colonial past, we certainly have imperial relations with a number of countries. And I would say the analog to all of those here is Mexican food. I can tell you, it would strike my brothers, for example, as unconscionable that they would pay, you know, $30 for a gourmet burrito. And similarly, Indian food, somewhat expensive, except for the wretched, you know, steam buffets that you find on weekends and at lunch. But in the UK, of course, it's fast, dirty, and cheap.
You know, you list a bunch of different countries, and as we said, you include Israel, you include Pakistan, India. Those are your list of irritating states, but you also put the U.S. in that list. Why is that?
You know, one of the things that has just struck me, particularly in the post-9/11 world, policies that had always irritated, obviously our Israel policy would be one of them, really took on new dimensions. And I thought it was really important that while we're being fed domestically a lot of images about tyrannies of outposts and axes of evil, and I thought it was important to really tackle head on that for most people in the world, we are actually the ones who irritate. It's very uncomforting. I love being an American, but I think we can do better.
Well, let's talk about your menus. What do you put in the menu for your dinner party when the U.S. is involved?
I'm from Indiana, and I do have, you know, a classic Indiana, you know, family reunion salad with all of the drippy Miracle Whip and frozen peas. But in the Great Satan Barbecue, I do a beer butt chicken. You get this chicken that's basically steamed and tenderized while getting a delightfully crisp chicken on the outside. It's almost impossible to get a dry chicken when you cook it with a can of beer up its behind.
And you do know that high-end food stores now sell contraptions to put them on the grill. It's not beer butt chicken. It's something with a much fancier name.
I saw it at Sur La Table, and it is approximately $25 or $35.
Right,
and
right.
I thought, a can of PBR works perfectly fine.
And we should say, for those who do not know the Midwest, Pabst Blue Ribbon. There you go. Let's talk about some of your other dinners for North Korea. You have a menu there, pickled cabbage, kimchi.
Now that, you know, I tell folk to not make. The marginal quality of making it in your own fridge doesn't really justify, A, the stink, or, two, the labor. So I do cheat, and I say to folk, buy it at the grocery store, and no one's going to know the difference. Just sprinkle some sesame seeds on it and cut up some scallions.
Okay, how about the Chinese dinner party? No MSG?
No. Look, China was tough because, you know, China is just an enormous culinary space. And I thought, what would be an interesting way to slice up an incredibly complex country with many cuisines? So I thought, wouldn't it be funny if we served the food of the areas where the intercontinental ballistic missiles that are pointed at us? The problem is, if you think about where we have our ICBMs, the food is not all that terribly good. So it took some effort trying to, you know, search down some recipes near the silos.
Well, if you had to settle down in a country, barring the U.S. and the Great Satan Barbecue, where would you live for the food?
Oh, see, that is a tough one. There is nothing like an American breakfast. We really hegemonize the pancake quality market. But the foods that I really am utterly in love with would be Iranian food because, A, they do a lot of meat, and in their stews, they'll often combine meat and fruit. And, of course, they're also carb people with their meat. Instead of meat and potatoes, they do a lot of meat and rice. And where can you go wrong with that combination?
Well, Chris, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Fair is author of Cuisines of the Axis of Evil and Other Irritating States, A Dinner Party Approach to International Relations. You can read an excerpt from her book at our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young returns tomorrow. Please join us again. Here and Now.